Today we continue our series on ethical dilemmas in the Holocaust through a Jewish religious spiritual perspective. And I want to begin with a story with an individual who has important Chicago roots and is extremely timely. Today is 3 days. Today is the 28th day. Of the Hebrew month of Teves. Everybody settling in. Three days ago was the 50th Yahrzeit. The word Yahrzeit is a Yiddish expression for anniversary of the passing of. Yahrzeit means the year's time. Of a man by the name of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels of blessed memory. This week, the 50th anniversary of the passing of the man known as the Weizen Rav. And being here in Chicago, talking about spiritual resistance, it is impossible. It would be terrible and wrong for us not to note this beacon of religious, spiritual, heroic greatness who resided here in this community. So obviously, he far predated my time here in Chicago and my time in general. But people in Chicago knew him, and people I know in Chicago describe him being such a warm, welcoming, embracing human being. And at the same time, he was also a towering, important, influential rabbinic figure. And the topic that we're going to weigh in on today relates to some of the issues that he faced during his lifetime. Because he was the rabbi before the war in a Hungarian community called Weizen. His father was also a rabbi. But when the Germans came in 1944 in the summer and started deporting all of the Hungarian Jews that they could get their hands on. So the Weizen Rav was deported together with them. He was sent to Auschwitz for a period of time. And some of his experiences in Auschwitz are in English published in this small volume called Shar Machmadim, which was published by the school here in Chicago called Yeshiva She'eres Yisrael, the Weizen Cheder. Why is it called the Weizen Cheder after Reb Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, the Weizen Rav, right here in Chicago?
I have no grandsons.
You have, exactly, you have grandsons.
Isn't this rabbi related to Rabbi Meisels, who is or was principal?
So the Ungers are the sons-in-law. Rabbi Unger is the son-in-law of the late Rabbi Meisels. I don't know if any Meisels who are here are related to him, because
no.
I think he...
Okay.
He also, after he survived the war, he published two volumes. This is one of them. I'm going to do a show and tell today. So I'm going to pass this around. This is extremely valuable and precious to me because this volume of this is the second half of the responsa that Rabbi Meisels published, was owned by my teacher, the great and saintly Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz of blessed memory. And after he passed away, someone procured this volume for me. It is a collection of responsa of Hungarian rabbis that he, Rabbi Meisels, knew before the war who answered Holocaust-related questions, and so that their names and their questions and their communities should not be forgotten, he collected them and published with them with his footnotes on the bottom. So I'm going to pass this around so you can take a look and see it. It's Hebrew, traditional rabbinic Hebrew. This collection, called Shar Machmadim, is the introduction to the first volume of Makat Sheshim that they published after his passing here in Chicago. And he tells a hair-raising, unbelievable story. And this story is going to be the entree to the topic that we're going to just touch upon today. Rabbi Meisels arrives in Auschwitz just before Rosh Hashanah of 1944. And he tells many stories in this introduction to Makat Sheshim, to the first volume. And he wrote, originally it was published in Hebrew, but now I have the translation here that I'm going to pass around for you. And he describes that on Erev Rosh Hashanah, the German guards rounded up 1,400 boys in a particular barrack. First, they had to pass underneath a bar, and any kid, any teenager, whatever, young man, if their head touched the bar, they were sent back to their barracks. But if they were below the bar, they were sent to this designated barrack. And they knew that this barrack meant that they were going to be facing their end immediately, not to be, you know, working any further. So Rabbi Maisel tells several incredible, amazing, heroic stories in this context. And one of them is about a father who approached him, an Oberlander Yid, who came over to me, said, "My son, my only son, is in the barrack of the doomed boys. And I have money that I smuggled in and I still have with me." And unfortunately, as we know, there were some Jews who became kapos, and some of them, against their will, whatever, but some of them, Rabbi Maisel says, were morally bankrupt, and they made very, very questionable choices. And so it was the case that there were certain kapos who were guarding this barrack who were open to being bribed. So this Oberlander Yid came over to Rabbi Maisel's, and he asked him, "Is it permitted, according to Jewish law, for me to buy my son's freedom if I know that the kapo is going to grab somebody else's child in his place?"
I'm surprised that he had even that much morality when he was trying to save his own son.
Oh, so what do you see just from this questioner? What a level of piety of a simple, unlearned Jew. What a level of spiritual commitment in that circumstance to have that frame of mind to ask a She'elas Rav. And it goes further, because Rabbi Maisel said back to him, the Weitzner said, "How can you expect me to answer under this current circumstance?" Even in the days when the temple existed and they had the great Sanhedrin, the great rabbinic court, he says, that's when they dealt with the most severe capital cases. In the middle of Auschwitz, you're going to ask what to do? So he describes how in his mind he thought back and forth what he should do, but he wasn't really, how's he going to answer him? But the simple Jew said to him, "Rebbe," he pleaded, "you must decide this burning question while I still have the chance." So the Weitzner said, "Please don't ask me to answer the question for you. I'm asking you, don't ask me. But this simple Jew said, "I want to do what is the halacha," which we're going to talk about what that means in a little bit. "I want to do what is right in the eyes of God according to Jewish law. Please help me do the right thing." So he said, the Weitzner said, "I can't tell you that I can give you a psak, a ruling. However," he said, after the man implored him, he said, "I'm asking you not to think that this is a psak, it's not a ruling, but, in his view," the Weitzner Rav said, "it would require the kapo to steal someone else's child, and it should not be done, he thinks, should not be done. Could you imagine the position that Rabbi Maisel was in? But now he says the coda is unbelievable. I should reframe what I just said. The man said that if you can't tell me that it's permitted, I'm assuming that it's not permitted, and I'm going to listen to that. And Rabbi Maisel said, don't say that it's a psak, but imagine that you never asked me. But he wasn't prepared to give him that psak that it's not allowed. But Rabbi Maisel says, and I'm reading in the English translation, sobbing profusely, he repeated his heartbreaking words and kept his promise to do nothing to ransom his son. All of that Rosh Hashanah day, he walked around expressing his joy as having merited to sacrifice his only son to God. He said, even though he could have done it, he knew that the Torah would not sanction. And therefore, he was our patriarch Abraham, says Rabbi Meisels. And guess what we can add? Our patriarch Abraham, when he took his son to the Akedah, to the altar, he went home with his son. But this Oberlander Jew, he, you could say, and who am I to say? I'm a nobody. He was greater than Abraham because he did sacrifice his own son. Maybe, maybe. What an unbelievable story. And this is just one of several that he describes from that Rosh Hashanah, from this doomed barrack. And you see in the words is seared the anguish of the Weizen Rav and having to deal with these kinds of questions. Surviving the war, coming to Chicago, totally broken and bereft, he rebuilt his life and he rebuilt his community. There's a beautiful pamphlet, I have it here, it's called Impact of Generations, that was just published, that I also wanted, there's a lot of show and tell today, I wanted to pass around, just so you should see, they have beautiful photographs of the Weizen Rav. This is a man who was committed to maintaining the tradition before Europe. His memory should be a blessing. It should be a righteous merit for all of us here in the Chicago community and for all Jews. Amen. So this story brings us to think about the main issue, the main ethical dilemma that we're going to talk about today. Now, this ethical dilemma requires a PhD, not a few minutes of an overview. This is one of the deepest, most difficult, challenging, vexing, and heart-rending questions that arose in the Holocaust. It primarily focused on the Judenrat, the Jewish councils who were responsible to provide information to Germans in their communities where they were, whether they were large cities or shtetlach. These were established councils by the Germans to get the census, the names, the professions, the identities. And this question was not limited to them, but primarily was focused on the issue of lists and names. And whether or not it is permitted, according to Jewish law, to give a list of names to the Germans to deport Jews to places unknown. Now, there are many wrinkles of this question, but it's the most serious and gravest question. Because on the one hand, you have the potential for the gravest, most serious avera, murder, accessory to murder. It's one of the three capital offenses for which one has to give their own life. And on the other hand, trying to save lives, Hatzalah, is the most noble of all halachic pursuits. If you are a traditional, observant, religious Jew, when you think about this type of dilemma, you instantly revert back to your mission in the world. You think about what is the will of Hashem, of God, that there is a purpose to life and every Jew is given a role and a mission by God. And there's something called halacha. Halacha, we have our whiteboard here, we'll use it. Halacha in Hebrew is hey, lamed chaf hey, which comes from the word holech, to go. It's a path. The halacha is a path by which a person leads their life to be in consonance with the will of Hashem. So people in the circumstance, Rahman al-Islam, no one should ever know from this, where they faced difficult ethical questions, these ethical dilemmas were not debated in traditional rabbinic circles by philosophizing. They weren't based on a person's pre-existing orientation of what morality is in a vacuum. They were shaped and guided by Jewish law, by halacha, which is going to dictate how a person lives. And what I'd like to do today with you, for the time that we have, is look at several primary sources in halacha to understand the context of those sources. And with this, you'll be able to understand how people were grappling. What were the questions that they were dealing with? Meaning, what are the tools? How would you even go about thinking about this? What are the texts that the rabbis and the observant Jews are constantly turning to when they think about these types of questions, and the questions are across the board. Even within these questions, obviously they are case specific, because at the beginning of the war, there was greater ambiguity when Germans asked for lists for deportation. What were those lists for? Where were the people being deported to? Were they just going to be working? Who knew? There was, you know, there was a lot of deception, you could say, that the Germans utilized in getting cooperation. They called it, remember, resettlement to the east in some of the cases. They're going to be working, all kinds of ruses of that type. As it gets later into 1941, 1942, certainly by 1943, many Jews are well aware that when somebody is being deported, especially to the locations where they were only death camps, in many cases they had some sense of where they might be being deported to, so then you know what that is. That's not forced labor. That's gas. That's being murdered. So that's an important wrinkle to know those differences. But there is a lot, an enormous amount of literature about this. If you want secondary sources, there is an excellent, fantastic Hebrew volume called V'hasineh Einenu Ukal. This is a very timely book, because in last week's Torah reading, we describe how Moses arrived at the burning bush, but the bush was not consumed. The symbolism here is that the Jewish people, and specifically Jewish tradition, Jewish observance, was on fire but not consumed. It was not destroyed by the Germans, by the Nazis. So he has a whole section, Yecheskel Shraga Lichtenstein, the author of this volume, a huge section summarizing many of the cases of Judenrat dilemmas, giving the historical background and details. For English, press two. For English, you have this is an amazing summary, secondary source, Hidden in Thunder. This is in the first volume of Esther Farbstein's Beseser Ram, where she catalogs many of these types of questions. One last one, which Blee Nader, I will send out by email afterwards so you can read the whole thing, is an article published in the Tradition magazine in the spring of 1991 by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf, called Surrendering Jews to the Nazis in the Light of the Halakha. So here you also have a couple of snippets, but these are the two big ones. And of course, this is a huge topic. Again, it could be a whole PhD. This could be a whole year. So I want to give you several texts. And these texts are the keys to understanding this question through the light of halakha. If you were a rabbi dealing with this type of conundrum, so you might be Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, who we've talked about, the author of She'elos U'Tshuvos Responsa Mimamakim, in the fifth volume, in the first essay, a very long essay about this type of thing. You might be another man we talked about, Rabbi Yehoshua Moshe Aronson, in the work camp called Kunin, a period of time in Auschwitz, but also in Kunin, authored the volume Alei Meroros, Bitter Herbs. We mentioned this also once in the past. So these are figures that we are familiar with, who are dealing with these kinds of questions. They're going to talk about the following text. The first one on your page is a Mishnah. The word Mishnah literally means to study, but this means it is a section, it is a piece of the oral tradition. When, if you're looking on the board here, when God appeared at Mount Sinai, he revealed himself at Sinai, he gave out two Torahs. You all thought he got one? No, he gave us two. He gave us a written Torah, and then he gave us an oral tradition. In addition to the actual text of the Chumash, of the Bible, there was a lot of explanation. There were tools, how to interpret it, how to understand it. Those tools were given to Moses, and that's going to be used for applying, interpreting law all through the generations. So let's say the Jews, let's say we'll start here. In the Hebrew calendar, it's going to be the year 2448 of creation. Revelation at Sinai, and Moses is going to pass this corpus of tradition, both the written and the oral, to his student Joshua, Yehoshua. Then he's going to give it to the elders, to the prophets. If you see on my whiteboard here, I have 40 dots. You can trust me. I counted them. 40 dots. Why? Because, we'll talk about him in a little bit, one of the most important Jewish halachic figures, Maimonides, we'll get to in a little bit. Maimonides counts 40 rabbinic personalities, starting with Moses, ending with the close of the Talmud, as the key authoritative arbiters and transmitters of the tradition. So 40 generations, we have their names. They're going to take us from Moses at Sinai. That's going to take us, the elders, the prophets, the first temple period, second temple period, past the second temple period, all the way down to the fourth, end of the fourth century of the Common Era. We're going to end with the close of the Talmud. What is the Talmud? The Talmud is a book that is a full exposition of much of the Mishnah. That's what we're talking about, the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a collection of rabbinic rulings, like, imagine, thumbnail sketches of law, like a collection of note cards, cue cards. And these note cards, you study them, and then you remember all the different rules and everything that goes along with it. Because due to the intense Roman persecution in the 3rd century, there was a concern that this tradition that's been going since Sinai, it's going to be, God forbid, potentially lost and forgotten. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi decided to edit the texts of this mission, of this teaching, and codify the basic principles, the basic rulings, and arguments. So, if you want to know, the bedrock of the original oral tradition in writing is going to be the text of the Mishnah. It's going to be edited around the year 230 of the Common Era. Parallel to this are going to be other same type of teachings at the same time. One is going to be called Brisa, and the other one is Tosefta. Same thing. These are collections of teachings in the 3rd century. They're summarizing the teachings of the last few hundred years, which is right here. You want to know what's authoritative? You're going to look in the Chumash, but after the Chumash, where are you going to look? In the prophets, in the books of the prophets, there are no laws. There are a handful of laws, but there's got to be some direction, some exposition, some application. That's what you're going to find in the Mishnah, and then it's going to be expressed much, much more elaborately with rationale and how to rule and what the majority is, what the consensus is by the Talmud. So here you have a passage in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says in source number one, all the translations in this packet are coming from Sepharia, which is a very helpful website if you're looking for source material sometimes where you need translation. Sepharia teaches the Mishnah. So we're going to hope their translation is good. I'm going to read in the Hebrew. You can follow in the English. The context here is about rulings regarding purity and impurity of fruit that has a level of sanctity that needs to be in a status of purity. And we're going to talk about purity now using a euphemism. A euphemism. And unfortunately, I will note that this circumstance is not theoretical. These types of abuses have occurred in Jewish history on countless occasions. And of course, right now, our hearts and minds are thinking of our brothers and sisters in Israel. It's a constant awareness. Our learning should also not just be a merit to the neshama of the Weizner Rav, whose yahrzeit was this week, but it should be a merit for all of the soldiers who are fighting on behalf of the Jewish people. It should be for a healing for all those whose bodies and hearts are broken. And so this is an example of something that an atrocity that was precipitated on women on October 7th. This is a similar type of circumstance at the hands of oppressors. The Mishnah says, Nashim sha'amru lahem nachrim, Gentiles who came to a group of women, Tenu achas mikem, give us one of you, unetame, and we will make that person defiled. So in the previous context, defiling means ritually impure. This context, it means abuse. V'imlav, hare anu metamim es kulchem. The gangsters, the Gentiles, the oppressors, the abusers, they say they're going to abuse all the women. They're going to molest everyone. What is the Mishnah rule? Yitamu es kulam. They should all be subjected to that coercive abuse. Va'al yimsru lahem nefesh achas Yisrael, and do not hand over one person. Now, there's an interesting question in this context, which we're not going to deal with right now, but it's worth keeping in mind, what if one person wants to volunteer? And this has happened in Jewish history in various forms, where a person, in a heroic way, there were all kinds of cases like this in Europe with some blood libel or something, they accused the Jewish community of killing someone, and a totally innocent man will come forward and said, I did it, and they'll burn him at the stake, even though he was totally innocent, to save others. So that's a very interesting question in halacha. Are you allowed to sacrifice your life for others?
That's happened with one of the hostages offering to stay.
Really?
One of the hostages said, there are women here older than me, take them.
Oh, yeah. So this is exactly this kind of question. Lo aleinu, who imagined that in the year 2023, Jews would still be facing these kinds of questions? Hashem should save us. So what do you learn from this Mishnah? That in the context of rape, lo aleinu, the Mishnah teaches us that the group does not have the right to pick one woman and quote-unquote sacrifice her for the benefit of the others. Well, that's in one context. What you're going to see now in source number two is that this is going to be expanded. Because in the Mishnah, here we are, Mishnah. The Mishnah is only talking about that case of physical abuse, Rachman Litzlan, lo aleinu. You should never know from such a thing. The Tosefta, which means it's a parallel text from the same time period, slightly less authoritative because it's not included by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the Mishnah, but other Mishnaic rabbis are including it. Look at this case. Now the case is expanded. Siyah shel bnei adam. You have a group of people. Sha'amru lahem goyim. The Gentiles said to them, Tenu lanu echad mikem. Give us one of you, v'nahargeu, and we will kill him. Give us that person to be killed. V'im lav. And if you don't give us one person, we're going to kill you all. Hari anu horgen eskulchem. You learn this Tosefta and you think, Shomu Shamayim is hair-raising. Says the Mishnah, Yehargu kulam, they should all be killed. Va'al yimsu lahem nefesh achas miYisrael, and do not hand over one individual Jew. You do not have the right to make a list and give one or two or three people, and through that spare the others. That's the Tosefta's ruling. Aval, however, im yichadu lahem, if they picked out the person themselves, they said, that man you must give over to us. Kagon sheyichadu, they identified le Sheva ben Bichri, yitnu lahem, va'al yehorgu kulam. Should give that man over to the non-Jews and not have everyone be killed. Caveat. What exactly does that mean? That they identified that man as Sheva ben Bichri. We got to figure out who is Sheva ben Bichri and what's the difference. Well, basic logic from this first analysis is going to teach us that the first case where the non-Jews didn't pick out an individual, they're telling us that we, as human beings, we don't have the right to sentence someone to death unjustly. And the first case of the Mishnah either. We don't have the right to sacrifice this one woman to be abused for the benefit of others. And a beautiful perspective on this is that from a Jewish standpoint, you cannot use mathematics to value life. Because from an abstract utilitarian person, you could say, this doesn't make sense. You have 10 people and you have one person. So why wouldn't you call that an act of hatzalah, of saving? The answer is because if in Jewish life every single individual is priceless, then in a certain sense, one is the same as 10 if it's about choosing. In the second case, the oppressors already chose that person. So you're not making the decision as the Judenrat or as the band of travelers. You're not making the decisions. The non-Jews made that decision. So you are not condemning the person to death. Death, they're already condemned to death by the oppressors. All you're going to do if you don't give them over is condemn other people to death also. So in that consideration, we're going to say that it's Hatzalah. Well, what does it mean that it's like Sheva ben Bichri? So we pointed out that the development of Halakha, starting from Sinai, can it travel all the way through the period of the Mishnahs, conclude with the period of the Talmud. Now, the Talmud is this authoritative body of work that takes positions on different opinions in the Mishnah. It also explains them and applies the rulings. The original beginning of the Talmud process began in Israel. It began in Israel just after the conclusion of the Mishnah with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Those sages began to develop and explain and explicate. The problem is that that high level of persecution caused a significant migration of Jews from Israel and the truncated work of the Talmudists in Israel. So that Talmud is called the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, or the Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud that was written in the land of Israel. But it was edited earlier and it's much shorter. The fuller Talmud, when you speak about Talmud, like the daily Talmud, the Daf Yomi, you're talking about the Babylonian Talmud. So you've got two Talmuds here. The earlier one is Talmud Yerushalmi, and the later one is Talmud Bavli. Well, the Talmud Yerushalmi has a commentary on Terumos. That's where this Mishnah is, and that's where this Tosefta is. Truma is about a tithe that's been given to a Kohen, or supposed to be given to a Kohen. That's done in Israel. The Jerusalem Talmud has commentaries on all the tractates about agricultural mitzvot in the land of Israel. In the Talmud Bavli, there is no exposition of these tractates. Why not? That's right. Exactly. Because in Babylonia, they weren't observing, just like in Chicago, we're not observing the mitzvos of the tithes. So when you look in the Jerusalem Talmud, there is a discussion how to interpret this. Says the Talmud Yerushalmi, look in the bottom section here on page 1, but you have the English on the top of page 2 if you like. There is a long discussion about this, and I put in the underline in the Hebrew if you want to follow it on the bottom. Amar Reb Shimon ben Lakish. And on the next column, and the next page, it's on the fourth line. Reb Shimon ben Lakish, who was one of the chief Talmudists, both cited in the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi, and in the Bavli. V'hu sheyechayev misa kesheva ben Bichri. The only time you're allowed to hand over that Jew is when he is chayev misa. He is already decreed a decree of death, like Sheva ben Bichri. So we have to explain what that is. Rabbi Yochanan says, Alpha Pisha Eino Chai of Misa Kesheva ben Bichri. Even though that person is not liable to be killed, he's not punishable for a particular crime like Sheva ben Bichri, nonetheless, you give him over to the Gentiles because he has been singled out. Who is Sheva ben Bichri? What is going on? Why is that Mishnah? Why is that Tosefta, and the Jerusalem Talmud quoting him? Turn the page. So if you look in the 2 Samuel, Shmuel Bet, King David faced a terrible crisis on so many levels, Nebuch. His own son sought to depose him. He had to run away from Jerusalem. On his way back, after he encounters various individuals, he hears that there was a man, his name was Sheva ben Bichri, who was continuing to rebel against King David. Even though the rebellion had been quashed, this one loner, this one insurrectionist, was still out there. So David comes back to Jerusalem. He resettles the monarchy. He gets his house back in order, and he says that his chief of staff has to go out there and take care of business. So Yoav, the army general in charge of all of David's issues, he goes out there in Pasuk 15. They came, the army, Vayatsur Olav Ba'avela Beis Hamacha. And Yoav's men they surrounded where Sheva ben Bichri was, this rebellious insurrectionist, and besieged him in Avela Beis Hamacha. I'm in source 4. Vayishbechu Sola El Ha'ir. Uh-oh, now they've got a siege, and they're going to start setting up a ramp. What's going to happen? They're going to quell this rebellion. Vatamod Bechel V'chol Ha'amasher Es Yoav Mashchisim L'Hapel Achoma. They're about to breach the wall. Vatikra Isha Chachama Min Ha'ir. A wise woman. Those two words generally go together. It's generally the women who are wise. She calls out. She says, "Listen up, Yoav. Listen to me. Come over here." Third verse. He comes over and she says, "Are you Yoav?" He says, "Yeah." She says, "Listen here. Vatomer Lamar, what are you looking for over here? What are you looking for? Anochi Shlume Emune Yisrael at Mavakesh Loham Yisir Vain Yisrael. I'm one who wants to worry about the Jewish community, and you're going to destroy a whole city. Why do that?" Yan Yoav, Vayan Yoav, and Yoav says, "Chalila, I'm not going to do that. No. Lochein Adavar," second to last one, "Ish Me'ar Ephraim," there's a guy, Sheva ben Bichri, he's rebelling against King David. I'm not going to kill all of you. So what does she say? Vatomor Isha El Yoav, Hinei Rosho, Mushlach Elecha Ba'arachoma. Don't worry. I'm going to throw his head over the wall, and everybody will sleep soundly tonight. So what does she do? Last verse. She was wise. She came to all the people. She said, "What are these shuganas? We have this one insurrectionist here. We're all going to be slaughtered because the king's men are going to put down the revolt." And what did they do? They said to her, "Darn right." So what did they do to Sheva ben Bichri?
Yeah.
That they cut off his head and they threw it over the wall. Exactly. So, what is the story with Sheva ben Bichri? Why did they cut off his head? Why would they cut off his head? Why would they kill him? Because in halacha, if you have a monarchy and somebody challenges the monarchy, an insurrectionist, Morid b'malchus is chayav misa. It's a capital offense. Now, insurrectionism, challenging and undermining the Davidic monarchy. So King David, the Gemara has a rule, Melech Porik Tzgeder, Morid B'Malchus, if somebody stands up against the king, and remember, in Judaism, the king is not just a government, it is the government. That person is considered treasonous, and treason is punishable by death. It's treason. So the reason they killed Sheva ben Bichri, and the reason why Yoav was there to kill Sheva ben Bichri, was because of treason. So now you plug this back into our machlokas, the argument, which there's a further argument than the Tosefta, and now you plug it into the Yerushalmi. There are two opinions. If the non-Jews come and they say, let's speak again about our context, the Germans come to the Jews, and they say, "Give us over an individual." Halacha would say, so far, you're not allowed to. But what if they say, "Give us over that person"? Well, it depends on whether or not they say, "Give us that person," according to Rabbi Yochanan, the second opinion in the Talmud. That person was singled out, you pass them over. But according to Reish Lakish, you only have the right to hand over that person that they single out if he is treasonous or for some other reason punished or liable to be punished with death. He's got to be the equivalent of Sheva ben Bichri, that he's going to be put to death for a reason. Now you're going to tell me, usually we have a rule. In Jewish law, you have to follow what it says in the Constitution or in the legislature. Dina de Malchusa Dina, the rule of law is the law. So let's say there's a sign and it says no speeding. And it says in the ordinance, in the village ordinance, if you speed 6 miles an hour over and you get caught by the camera, they're going to send you a ticket in the mail. It's going to cost you $35. Can you say, I'm a Jew, I don't follow secular law, I only follow halacha? I don't have to pay $35. No. Dina de malchusa dina. The halacha, I only follow halacha. I don't follow anything else, but the halacha says that you have to follow the law of the land. If the law says you speed in a school zone, you pay a $35 ticket. I'm only speaking theoretically right now. I'm not saying that maybe somebody got this in the mail, so I know this halacha. So the halacha is, I can appeal it to the city of Chicago, but if they tell me after my appeal that I have to pay, I have to pay. That's the halacha. So maybe you should say, well, maybe the Jews have to listen to the Germans because it's Dina de Malchusa. No, Dina de Malchusa only applies to rules that are laws of the land, that are not discriminatory. If they're going to single out Jews to be discriminated against, Rachmana Litzlan, in this building, in this museum, you see and you demonstrate, and many of you teach about that type of discrimination, that is not a fair and just law, and the halacha says you don't have to follow it. So just because the Germans decide that they should kill someone, you do not apply Dina de Malchusa Dina. So this is where we now have an argument. We have an argument between Rabbi Yochanan who said, anybody who the Gentiles identify can be handed over to save the majority, the larger group. And Reish Lakish says, no, they're only going to be handed over if they are culpable of a capital crime. So how do you resolve such a question? Well, sometimes you're going to have the resolution provided by the Talmud itself. It will say, Hilchasa, the law follows such and such. But a lot of times it does not. And that tradition is going to go on through the period post-Talmudic time, what's called the Savoroim and the Gaonim, the geniuses and the great commentators, all the way until the period of the Rishonim. The early commentators are going to start in the 11th century. They're going to have to take sides on these kinds of arguments. Well, you had Rishonim, you had early commentaries all across Jewish life in Sephardic countries, North Africa, Spain, Babylonia, and you're also now having commentaries and rules being put down in other parts of the diaspora, in Ashkenaz, so in France or Germany or Italy, different communities. One of the world-renowned, recognized authorities in Jewish law in the Rishonim is Maimonides. So here he is on the top, 1135 till 1204. That's when we think he lived. Easiest way to remember this is he lived just less than a half hour. So you just put the two dots on the board there. That's how long Maimonides lived. He's known as the Rambam because his name is Moshe ben Maimon. Maimonides is Rambam. There was an expression people used to say, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, lo kam kemoshe. From Moshe at Sinai to Moshe of Rambam, Maimonides, there was no halachic authority like that. It was a major, major authority. So what the Rambam says is going to have a lot of weight. So take a look on the next page. And this is in the Rambam's Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, the foundations of Torah. First, he quotes the case of the women, of the abuse of the women, Rachmana Litzlan. And then on the second line, V'chein im amru lahem ovdei kochavim, if the non-Jews say to them, Tenu lanu echad mikem, give us one, v'nahar genu, and we'll kill him. V'im lav, and if not, narugis kulchem, we'll kill you all. What? Yehargu kulam v'al yimsu lohem nefesh achas miYisrael. They should all be killed and not give over one man. V'im yichaduhu lohem. And if they specified one, v'amru, and they said, Tnu lanu ploni, give us one individual, this specific person. Oh, and if not, narogas kulchem, we'll kill all of you. What does the Rambam rule? Im haya mechuyav misa, kesheva ben bichri, yidnu oso lahem. Only if the person is culpable, if they are justifiably meant to be put to death anyway, like Sheva ben Bichri, the treasonous rebel, then you can give them over. He rules according to Reish Lakish, and he goes to the end of the Rishonim, and then he adds, Ve'ein morin lehem kein lechatchila, you shouldn't even advise this a priori. We should avoid handing people over. Well, now this becomes a huge source of controversy, because generally when you have a dispute between Rabbi Yochanan on one side and Reish Lakish on the other, usually we follow Rabbi Yochanan. And the Rambam, pointedly, does not. He follows Reish Lakish. So thousands of pages, maybe not thousands, but certainly hundreds, thousands of gallons of ink, you could say, have been spilled over trying to understand why the Rambam ruled the way that he did. And why we'll have, obviously, when you understand the why, you understand how to apply it. But the key for us is that if you are a rabbi in Kovno or Vilno or Warsaw, and you're thinking about this issue, what is front and center in your mind? This ruling of the Rambam. It's not the only ruling, but it is a very important figure. And this is a ruling that needs to be considered. So now we're going to take the halacha and try to move it forward, because there have been many people who are going to weigh in post the period of Maimonides. So we're going to get to the set table. Here we have a table. Imagine you have it set beautifully. All you need to do is sit down and eat lunch, because Rav Yosef Karo, the great Sephardic codifier, author, commentator, living first, he lives in Spain, then his family is expelled with the Spanish expulsion, then he's going to Turkey, then he's settling in northern Israel in Tzfat in the 16th century. Rav Yosef Karo, he sets up the table, this set table of how to observe. And that is not the only view in Jewish law, but of course that's going to be another very important view in Jewish law. But he's writing in a specific context in the Sephardic. Comes Rav Moshe Isserles in Krakow, known as the Ramah. Those who've been in Krakow, anybody here ever been to Krakow? You're probably at the Ramah synagogue. It's one of the most famous synagogues. You've been there?
Yes,
I have. So I've never been there, but you know what I'm talking about. The Ramah, very famous Ashkenaz posek, rabbinic decisor. So he has glosses on the Shulchan Aruch, and in Yoredei, in the second section of the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch deals with laws of mitzvos and rules and Gentiles, he has an important gloss. Says the Rama on the bottom of source, at the bottom of the page here, source 6, Ov dekochavim, and he summarizes everything that we've gotten until now. Sha'amru l'Yisrael, Gentiles, this is Rama. It's a special script that they usually put, so I put it there special. You could feel like you're learning the Rama. Sha'amru l'Yisrael, that they said to the Jews, Tenu lanu echad mikem, give us one of you. V'na'ar genu, will we kill him? Lo yitnu lahem echad mehem, do not give him. And what does he quote in the parentheses? The attribution, the Mishnah in Trumos, which was talking about the women, but we saw the Tosefta about the men. V'harambam, the Maimonides we saw. Ella, im kain, yichadu v'amru tenu lanu ploni, unless they said, this is the man. So, according to the first opinion, the Judenrat would not be allowed, according to Jewish law, unless the Gentiles identified that person for deportation by name, they would not be allowed to hand over specific individuals. Now, the Judenrat is allowed to give in papers of all the people who are living there, and then if the Gentiles pick the names on the people, that would be the first opinion. However, this is the first view. Remember, this was Rav Yochanan's view, not the view of the Rambam, but other Rishonim. V'yesh omrim, and there are those who say, da'afilu b'chi ha'gavna, even in such a circumstance, ein lamosro, do not give him over, ela imkein chayav misa kesheva ben bechri, unless that person is culpable as a treasonous rebel like Sheva ben Bechri. So according to the second view, unless the Jew who is being handed over is, for some reason, Chayav Misa, which is a very far-fetched circumstance, unless, God forbid, it's a Mosa or something like that, it would not be permitted to give it over. And that's why in many of these cases that Esther Farbstein surveys in the book, rabbis, when they were approached about these types of issues, they're very reticent, they're very opposed to giving names. And so this is the calculus. I'm not going to give one ruling, obviously. And even if one were to analyze anyone's ruling in that period, we would never, God forbid, stand in judgment. The same way that the Weizner Rav said he shuddered at having to answer this question, which he didn't even want to answer. Now, some rabbis didn't have a choice, and they gave the answer. So the tshuvas, we mentioned the responses before. But you see that the direction of the halacha is very minimalist. It's not utilitarian. You might have come into this discussion assuming that we're going to look at the aggregate, which in the view of some of the secular officers of some of the Judenrat, they view their actions in that moment. And again, we're not judging them. They view their actions as actions of hatzala, as saving. Because if they can sacrifice few, perhaps they can save the many, which even then, you never know in the end if that did anything. They could only make a judgment call based on what they saw and what they understood, given the circumstances that they had. But you could see why in many, if not most, or almost all cases, the rabbis were opposed to sacrificing few in the favor of many because of this orientation. And I think it comes back to that general principle that we talked about in the beginning, which is that for Jews, every life is infinite. And so therefore, there's no such thing as saying 10 is more valuable than one. We're not going to make that calculus. We're not going to sacrifice one person. So are there differences in the cases and in the specific rulings? Yes, and I encourage you to take a look at the different nuances between whether they're being selected for labor or being selected for deportation or different kinds of things and what they knew and what they didn't. But just to understand how would a rabbi approach a halachic dilemma like this, these are the type of sources that they're going to use. These are just six of the basics. What's going to happen after this that you'll see, let's say, in that response on the fifth volume, the first one of Mima Makim of Rav Oshri, who survived the Kovno ghetto, is he's going to marshal many, many more sources. Already in the commentaries of the Shulchan Aruch, in the 17th century, the 18th century, they're quoting cases and issues, and this was a common thing. So these are just the basic primary laws, but now you're also going to have case precedent of different tshuvas, responsa, that are going to be marshaled in favor and how to explain and address every particular situation. But the goal is just to realize that there were such Jews who were so committed, and the reason why in many, if not most, of the cases where this came up, rabbis were opposed, it's because of this orientation that you see in many of these primary sources. Doesn't mean this is the only view, but this is certainly an important view to keep in mind when you think about it. And that means that any time a traditional rabbinic or layperson, an observant Jew, is thinking about any type of crisis, this is a way to think about it. It's to go to the texts to understand what does God want from a person in a given circumstance to do the best that they can, using the halacha as their guide. So just part two of this discussion, which will be the dilemma for next time, is it permitted for a person to endanger themselves to save others? That'll be next time's discussion.